This podcast was produced by the Center for Gender Studies at Banyan University and Recollective as part of the ProGender podcast series.
In this podcast, we focus on gender-based violence and the Me Too movement in Greece and Norway.
I am Aleki Kosifologou. I hold a PhD in political science and sociology. And currently, I work as a researcher for RLS Germany.
While lockdowns were necessary to limit and contain the spread of COVID-19, they also had a devastating impact on women and girls living with the risk of gender-based violence. And many of the factors that trigger or perpetuate violence against women and girls multiplied with the confinement and the policing enforced during these lockdowns. So could you give us an idea of what the impact of the lockdown was on gender-based violence in Greece?
Well, I think we all are still processing this impact and these multi-layered consequences of the COVID-19 health crisis. Fortunately, in Greece, I believe that gender-based violence was actually the shadow pandemic. And in a way, it coincided with a crisis of the welfare services, which is also a long-term consequence of the implemented austerity policies for the past decade in Greece. So the COVID-19 outbreak, the counter-pandemic measures created significant difficulties and challenges for the provision of care and support for the gender-based violence survivors. Also, the restrictions in movement and the travel bans were significant obstacles that the gender-based violence survivors should overcome just to seek help. And unfortunately, the most vulnerable groups among women and children were exposed in increased gender-based violence risks during the pandemic. Refugee women, women in refugee settlements all around Greece, single parents, low-skilled women workers, they were mostly targeted by these risks. So unfortunately, we do have the data, but we also have the experience, widespread news that during the pandemic, gender-based violence exacerbated in Greece.
And during the COVID-19 lockdowns, the Me Too movement began in Greece.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to hear your views about its impact on public discourse, as well as how it has affected the dominant perceptions and reactions towards gender in general and gender-based violence, in particular in Greece.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in general, the feminist movement in this moment, and of course during this really original experience of 2 years of the pandemic, it was almost the most impactful political and social movement. Of course, the Me Too movement, which actually began during, or not actually, as you say, in the midst of the COVID-19 lockdown, was particularly impactful in terms of public discourse. And it transformed really significantly perceptions on gender and sexuality. But I think that there was a very interesting shift in public discourse on the issues of gender a little before the outbreak of the pandemic, in the light of these atrocious femicides since 2018, let's say. And it's really interesting because a new vocabulary is introduced in public speech regarding gender issues. Sometimes it is a feminist vocabulary, and even the word femicide was introduced, which is something really original in terms of media coverage of gender-based violence crimes in the past. So this is, I think this is very important. And it also reflects this mature consciousness gender issues that has developed during these recent years. So yes, it was a very impactful movement. On the other hand, of course, the media still reproduce some kind of tension around the gender issues. I think it's pretty obvious that it is a moment in the Greek society that gender can become again an issue that could politically polarize the society. So, of course, the media are entering this debate, and there are a lot of contradictory discourses that are being reproduced. But yes, there is positive change. We cannot disregard that. I mean, it's definitely, and this is something that happened also because of the Me Too movement.
Mm-hmm. What we've seen with the emergence of the Me Too movement in Greece was also a move from an exclusive focus on violence against women towards a more inclusive approach that includes also gender-based violence that targets LGBTQ. So do you think that this move has influenced more broadly gender politics and activism in Greece?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, LGBTQ plus political openness is increasing in Greece. And this is amazing. It's really positive. I was reading one of ILGA's annual reports, the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans and Intersex Association, that was reporting that Greece was the top European country for improvements in terms of LGBTQ plus visibility during the period 2014-2018, something which is, it's an achievement. And I think this is an achievement of the movement. So it's something to celebrate and be proud of course. And of course, there is a more gender inclusive and a more intersectional approach that is established in radical politics and the social movements in Greece. And the left, the Greek left, is also more open to this intersectional approach, which is also a very positive development. And I think this is something that was built during the crisis years. And I think it comes back, it goes back to the first period of the anti-memorandum protests in Greece. So I think this is really important. But on the other hand, there is still a lot of fragmentation in terms of approaching all these issues. It's still new, and there is a positive development, but I think intersectionality is in its beginnings in the movement at this moment. Another very important issue, in my opinion, is that the so-called Generation Z has really progressive views on gender and sexuality. And there is growing awareness on issues regarding bullying, sexual harassment in the school environment, in university. And I think this is a very interesting development that might define our society within the next years. Personally, I am really amazed by how this thing has evolved during these 5-6 years. I mean, today's 20-year-olds are considerably more mature than I was when I was in their age in regards to issues of gender, sexuality, etc. So I think this is very important. I don't know. There are lots of weaknesses considering LGBTQ in terms of state policies. So, I mean, this is also another discussion. And I think the networks that can provide support to LGBTQ gender-based violence survivors are really weak and are really left to the private sector. Mainly non-governmental organizations provide the support. I'm not sure if there are any, I don't know, accommodation structures for gender-based violence survivors that belong to the LGBTQ plus community. So I think this could be or should be a political debate within the new, within the next years also.
And during the pandemic, we saw very large protests and public debates on gender issues. These permeated all aspects of social and political life. But do you think that the strength of these movements will be translated into actual changes in policies? You already mentioned the difficulties that we have, the Greek political system has with moving forward with LGBTQ rights. What about gender-based violence? Can you see any changes coming in the near future regarding gender-based violence?
Well, unfortunately, we have seen a negative change, a negative development, because a New Democracy decided, the Greek government decided to reform the family law the last spring. And this reform aiming to redefine the child-parent relation and other family issues actually disregards the aspect of gender-based violence. I mean, even international human rights organizations have acknowledged that this law is a major backlash to women's and children's rights in Greece. So unfortunately, we have seen a negative development, because for a neoliberal government, it's really easy in terms of discourse to embrace feminism and the Me Too movement and support survivors in terms of, you know, discourse. But when it comes to implement actual policies that aim to eliminate gender-based violence, of course, things are very challenging. And we understand the absence of the social policy structures. To do so, you have to also have a welfare state that functions properly and can provide all this care. So, yes, we have seen, unfortunately, a negative development. But I don't know. I mean, during the last decade, we have seen some positive developments regarding LGBTQ plus rights, the cohabitation agreement that was voted in 2015, the recognition of gender identity also in 2017. They're both two positive legal developments. And in somehow it is an expression of political struggle, of a social struggle to the political level. I mean, these two were definitely two very positive developments in terms of legislation and policies.
My name is Diana Manesi. I am an independent researcher. I've completed my studies in social anthropology, and I've worked in the field of gender-based violence in Greece for the past 3 years. So I worked as an educator trainer on gender and gender violence, but also conducted researches in the field of gender-based violence, basically with a focus on refugee population, but not only. And I'm currently a postdoctoral researcher on gender and science and technology.
While lockdowns were necessary to limit and contain the spread of COVID-19, they also had a devastating impact on people living with the risk of GBV. I was wondering if you could tell us a few words about what happened during the lockdown regarding GBV in Greece.
Well, there was an increase in numbers, obviously, of GBV cases. I don't have an exact number to tell you, but there was a rise in the number of calls received for gender-based violence. I think one of the most important impacts was the fact of the shifting between the public and private. Regarding gender-based violence, usually the situation is that the private sphere is, meaning the house in this case, is a source of violence. So it's necessary for women to leave the house. So you usually create a risk assessment plan and an exit strategy, etc. So in this case, we had a situation where women who were in a violent relationship or in a violent environment in the house could not actually leave the house. And there was a social cultural aspect of the private sphere being considered as secure in terms of contamination, COVID contamination. So we have this contradictory dialogue between the private sphere being regarded as a source of violence for women survivors of gender-based violence that were forced to stay in the house. So you have a rise of violence basically because a couple or a family or relatives are stuck in a house. So you are stuck with a violent partner there. And at the same time, you have a government and policy that treats the private sphere as a source of security and health safety. So this was a culturally contradictory discourse going on. And obviously, there's been a rise in numbers of gender-based violent cases. And it's no coincidence also that we had an increase on the number of femicides in Greece during the last 2 years with COVID. Obviously, I don't want to create a cause and effect link between femicides and lockdowns. I don't want to create the impression that GBV created something or highly increased something, basically violence, gender-based violence and femicide. But for sure, it had a devastating impact on the lives of women. And if we take the example of refugee and migrant women, there were many cases, for example, because the courts were closed. So you had many cases of women that, for example, were waiting a court order to get their child back, or to have penalty measures against the perpetrator, and they were basically stuck in also the refugee system because the courts were not working. So you could have delays of women waiting to get their children back from the perpetrator for almost like 2 years, or have like penalty measures against the perpetrator also for 2 years. So it also depends on the class status of the women that were involved in a gender-based violence situation.
I would like to hear your views about the impact of the movement on public discourse and how it has affected the dominant perceptions and reactions towards gender in general and GBV more particularly in Greece.
It gave a lot of visibility. And I think that's the most important gain. It gave a lot of visibility to women and empowered a number of women to speak out. For sure, this was also combined with a rise of feminist and LGBT movement in Greece at the same time. It increased the visibility for sure. So you have more and more women coming out or actually delegitimizing intimate partner violence as something that is okay or culturally acceptable. This was an important shift in public perception that, you know, intimate partner violence is a crime. So in that sense, it's starting to be culturally delegitimized as something okay to be happening, or is it something that is happening in the private sphere, or is something between family members and you know, society should not intervene into it. So we had more increased visibility. The social media played an important role, especially if you regard the use of terms, like the word femicide was started to be used in social media. Mainstream media were not using it. They were actually reproducing victim blaming, but also re-traumatizing women that were coming out as survivors of gender-based violence. So this play between social media and mainstream media in terms of shifting how terms are used or how intimate partner violence is treated was important. Of course, I don't think in terms of public policy or governmental policy that we have seen any important shifts. If you consider, for example, that at the same time, you know, the Me Too movement was also to a great extent mainstreamed and at the same time incorporated by the government of New Democracy in ways that were not kind of giving voice or, you know, going to the direction of protecting or victims of gender-based violence. For example, there were no measures to increase hostels, basically, for women. So we still have a limited number and a huge increase at the same time. So the structural problems are still there. No measures were taken to kind of like increase protection measures for victims of gender-based violence. No extra social services, no extra psychologists or free legal aid, for example, and basically infrastructure, because a lot of women don't have any refugees to go. So, you know, at the same time, in practice, we have no extra measures. So I think, though it is optimistic that we had the Greek Two movement in Greece, and also it was something that was very, it concerned a lot, you know, white women and women that had, that were public figures in a sense. It's part and parcel of the Greek, of the Me Too movement worldwide. It was a movement that was about actresses and singers, etc. So in that sense, we could say that, okay, it gave visibility to this, to gender-based violence, but at the same time, intersectional aspects, for example, ethnicity, or the fact that most women were white and public figures, or that at the same time, maybe the debate, it was such a media, informed movement that, for example, aspects that had to do with these intersectionality or the state measures and the lack of state measures were not addressed that much from the media. So I think that was also part of the problem. So there was not an exact link forged between the feminist and LGBT movement and the movement against femicide and the media infused discourse and movement on the, in media and social media and mainstream media. So there was, you had like two parallel discourses that didn't necessarily meet. That's how I at least see it. But for sure, from my experience as a GBV educator, but also as a researcher, I think it has legitimized a bit more that we can openly discuss about these things. And, you know, it's more valid for a woman to come out and say, I'm being abused by my partner than it was in the past. And also the kind of shift of the name, using the term femicide instead of honor crimes, for example, which was, it's in the Mediterranean, at least, this is how they were portrayed for many, many years in the media, but also culturally they were considered as honor crimes, so, or crimes out of jealousy and out of love. Starting to delegitimize this cultural aspect is very important for gender equality or for, you know, gender issues in general in Greece. But as I said earlier, with the name of the General Secretariat, the change of the name, but also another a lot of other policies that are against gender equality and against the empowerment of women, based, I'm not very optimistic about the shifts that the Me Too movement has affected.
You mentioned before that the emergence of the Me Too movement coincided with the rise of the LGBTQ movement. And I think this has led to a move from an exclusive focus on violence against women towards a more inclusive approach to GBV that addresses also violence against LGBTQ plus, but also against migrants, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you think that this move has influenced more broadly gender politics and activism in Greece.
Well, I personally always treated gender-based violence in an inclusive and intersectional way. So, for example, that's why we don't use the term violence against women anymore, and we use the term gender-based violence, because a hate crime against a gay kid in the countryside, for example, is an example of gender-based violence. So I don't know if you remember, there was this case in Kalymnos where a gay kid was outed and he was in a relationship or was having casual sex with another person, and the other person leaked the video, that the sex video of him with the other person, and the father committed suicide. So this is a classic example of a gender-based violence case affecting LGBT people. I mean, to be honest, the term violence against women in gender politics, if I can say it, like in NGOs, etc., is not that much used anymore. I don't think there is enough discussion about, for example, intimate partner violence in LGBT couples at all. I think we're not there yet to open that discussion. I think the way gender-based violence is discussed, what it has to do with women, it's discussed mostly in terms of their relationship with their partner. But not only, it has to do with any family member. But it, in public discourse, it's mostly discussed with their relationship with their husband. So it's in a heterosexual family context. When it comes to LGBT people, it's either discussed in terms of the relationship of gay and lesbians and trans people with their family or with police forces. So it's not discussed in terms of the relationship with their partner. So we have a different kind of discussion of gender-based violence in a heterosexual family setting and in the LGBT setting. I don't think it's much that's discussed. Even in gender activism, I think there is a lot of work to be done in terms of finding the intersectional lines between these two things. I think maybe gender-based violence is interpreted as an umbrella term when it comes to LGBT violence. So we can see how also the gender-based violence is kind of like becoming an umbrella term when we shifted to LGBT people, because then you have to discuss more openly, again, police brutality, structural violence. So it shifts the focus from a heterosexual family setting to police brutality, structural violence, coming out, family relations, etc. Whereas the public discourse, when it has to do with heterosexual couples, it's limited a lot to the couple. You can discuss structural violence and police violence, but not exactly in the same extent when you shifted to LGBT people. There was a general increase in the LGBT movement, you know, after the murder of Zach Kostopoulos. So that was an important aspect of the LGBT movement here in Greece in terms of discussing police brutality, but also kind of like the silencing mechanisms of the state. How also the justice system works in Greece, how it perpetuates violence. There are many links if you think about it. Like if a woman goes to report a GBV case to the police and she's an immigrant and she speaks a broken Greek, for example, it's very possible that she won't be taken seriously. And at the same time, you know, you had the murder of Zach Kostopoulos by police forces. So, discussing violence in terms of gender, I think there are many lines that we can connect between when discussing basically state violence. I'm sorry if my answers seem a little bit scattered. I'm trying to think of all the factors at the same time. But for example, regarding violence against women, the fact that the police or the state does not a law at all is just starting to acknowledge this as a valid crime in the last 2 years. And I mean, not in terms of it being recorded, but, you know, but it being also legitimized as women as not the ones reporting a crime, but as the ones needing protection. So it all has to do with, for example, the focus of the police on prosecution instead of protection. And this has been an ongoing thing in Greece. It has been more reinforced by New Democracy, the current government, New Democracy. So I think that is also an important aspect, the way police treats gender-based violence as a prosecution thing and not as a protection case. Well, in activist terms, it's very interesting because we had a lot of feminist groups that were raising against the police for femicides throughout these two last years. I mean, this year we've had already 16, I don't know, maybe, correct me if I'm wrong. But at the same time, we also have trans feminist groups and collectives that are trying to raise awareness to other forms of gender-based violence going on. And I think this shift also is interesting that, you know, the feminist and LGBT movement has so many different voices at this moment. So you have groups against femicide, that you could say are more old school, if I could use this term. But at the same time, you also have trans feminist groups against femicides. And, you know, maybe it's something that we need to discuss why we use the term, femicide. Like, is it also against femininities? So it's more about, crime against femininities. So than just a crime against women. But also what I've noticed is that the LGBT movement has a kind of agenda that sometimes is not necessarily interacting with mainstream society. Because, you know, the LGBT people, I mean, I don't want to speak on behalf of them, but, you know, you want to create a world that is safe for you. So creating safe spaces for the LGBT community is very important. But at the same time, when you create safe spaces, you may lose the interaction with mainstream society. So I think that is where the gap is going on. Because you have an increase of violence against women. And, you know, many straight women out there that are empowered but don't have necessarily this feminist tools or trans feminist tools to discuss crime against women in these terms, in LGBT terms. And at the same time, you have an LGBT community that wants to create safe space for its people and also protest against gender-based crimes. How can these two different discourses interact? You know, the mainstream that is, okay, we have like women being killed or women being victim blamed or raped. And then, you know, the case, for example, in Thessaloniki with Yuria, the woman that came out as being raped and then she was banished from the media and, you know, slut shamed basically. But how can the LGBT movement, for example, interact with Yuria? Who is, you know, a woman, a straight woman with different tools, very heterosexual, heteronormative tools to discuss rape and discuss gender-based violence. So it is a challenge. And I think it is interesting that these different discourses coincide and come together at this point. And for sure, Greece has a vibrant feminist and LGBT movement than it used to have in the 1990s and the early zeros. And much more outspoken, much more valid, and much more aggressive also. Aggressive in a good way, like in taking over the streets and reclaiming the streets. So I think it is promising, yes.
I was wondering if these can be translated into actual changes at the policy level. And to give you an example, what you mentioned before about the shelters that provide protection for victims, for example, are only for women. So even if, as you mentioned, we have moved forward towards a conception of gender-based violence that is more inclusive, we still have policies that are focused on violence against women. So there are no shelters for LGBTQ, there are no shelters for trans people, and very often for male victims of gender-based violence. So I was wondering if you could comment on that.
There is no state support for LGBT people, that's for sure. Like even the helpline that works by Orlando is not state funded. So it's not state supported, it's not state funded, and it's always, as far as I know, they're always trying to find a way to preserve it. So you don't actually have a helpline as a state for LGBT people. That is indicative. You only have the 5900, which is for gender-based violence, but not specifically for LGBT people that need have different needs. So as you said, right, shelters are mostly for women and for women that have children until 14 years old. We don't have anything for male victims of torture victims, for example, or war victims, etc. We don't have for trans people, and we don't have for gay and lesbians or any sort of people that are non-conforming genders, etc. So that is indicative of the gap between the activist discourse and the state and the structural violence. Even for women, the shelters were a product of the second wave feminist movement. So it's not, you know, concerns about gender equality or gender issues were considered by the state before the second wave feminist movement in Greece in the 1980s. That's when we had the shelters. for women, and still they're very, very much limited in number. There are also no short stay shelters. So if you have an emergency of a woman that needs to stay somewhere for the night, there are no short stay shelters. So most shelters are for long term, I meaning like 2-3 months. But, you know, you don't have an emergency accommodation. That's the word I was searching. There's no emergency accommodation for women either. The, you know, Greece is a very conservative society that is forced to do things for LGBT and trans people, basically because it has a vibrant movement at the moment, and it's also a member of the EU. So they are forced, and that's how we see kind of like Europe and Europeanization being a force of modernity, if we could use that, speak like that. Most of LGBT rights are a product of EU policies that Greece was forced to incorporate in order to align its legal framework. In terms of policies, I'm not very optimistic. There are no shelters also, like for trafficking victims, there's only one shelter, I think, in Thessaloniki. So in terms of infrastructures, there are huge, huge gaps, and they're not prioritized. It's not a priority of any government to address gender-based violence. So, you know, the numbers are speaking by themselves, but at the same time, it's not ignorance, but it's lack of interest. It's a political choice not to address gender-based violence. It's a political choice to ignore trans people as long as you are capable to do it. As long as they don't go to the European Court for Human Rights, and then you are forced as a state to do it. That's how I've seen LGBT politics work in Greece. And that's very, very sad in terms of, you know, how LGBT people lead their lives here. And how also women, GBV survivors, have options or have very, very limited options to get out of a circle of violence. Because also you need to consider that gender-based violence is a crime that has different particularities. So you are, as a woman, trapped in this circle of violence. It's not that you are like robbed one day and you call the police to come to your house. You are trapped in a circle of violence, so you will try to leave the perpetrator on average 7 times. That is the average number, not in Greece, but in the UK, because I've also worked at the National Domestic Violence Helpline in the UK. That was the average number of a woman leaving the relationships and coming back. And that's not also only in Greece. Like in the UK, as far as I worked there, they had also a limited number of accommodation and shelters for women. But since we're talking about Greece, yeah, trans people, they just received the right to change their documents in Greece. They were going through a whole procedure to do that before then. Like they needed a psychiatrist paper, and then they had to go to the courts, etc. It was simplified after the Gender Recognition Act, which also happened because of European pressure. And the same goes for the cohabitation contract. Most LGBT rights have come as a product of Europeanization in Greece, which, you know, I don't want to at the same time create that dichotomy between modernity and traditionalism and say, you know, that Greece is a traditional society and we're so happy that to have Europe that is kind of like forcing changes. And I'm not going to also argue that LGBT people are not finding ways also to support themselves. Like even within the pandemic, there was a self-organized group called Queers Against the Pandemic or something like that. Queers in support of people that could not go out of the house during the pandemic. So you had like self-organized groups that were actually trying to help each other. So you have solidarity networks at the same time. LGBT people cannot count always to their families for support. So if they're trapped in a violent, intimate violent partner relationship, or if there are, for example, they're arrested by the police, or they're beaten up, or they are being checked for their papers, they don't have the family to count upon. And that is very, very important, because the whole welfare state in Greece is family-based. So if you're not an heterosexual person, you automatically, you lose that a welfare support system, which is the family in Greece. It is a family because the state does not want to offer any kind of other support, so it treats the family as the space that will protect grandparents, the children, survivors, GBV survivors, etc. So that's how you have also the reproduction of gender-based violence within the household, because the household is the one that's the welfare provider. What if the household is at the same time the source of violence and the welfare provider?
My name is Else Marie Augusti. I'm a researcher at the Norwegian Institute on Violence and Traumatic Stress Studies. It's a national research institute working on the health aspects of being a victim of violence, abuse, terror, and so on. And I have a PhD in developmental psychology. That's my background. Yeah.
You have been working extensively on violence against children in Norway. Can you tell us what are the main forms of violence against children that you have studied and what happened during the pandemic?
Sure. Well, as you were mentioning, my study on violence against children goes back in time and even before the pandemic. And actually in 2019, the team that I'm a part of, we were the first to conduct a large prevalence study in Norway on violence and abuse against children, including psychological abuse, physical violence, sexual abuse, both by an adult and peers, and also neglect. So we cover a broad spectrum of violence against children as defined by World Health Organization. And this study, this prevalence study that we did, it reached out to more than 9,000 adolescents in Norway, aged 12 to 16 years of age. And we were the first large-scale study to be able to apply a new amendment to the Norwegian law on health research, allowing us to ask kids as young as 12 years of age to participate in research without parental consent. And this was a very important step forward for this research, because we know that kids might not be allowed to participate in this type of research if their parents have to consent, and especially children that are subject to violence and abuse at home. So in 2019, we released the results from this large-scale study, and this put us also in a very good position to monitor violence and abuse against children during the pandemic, because we have this baseline information about the situation for children before the pandemic, and also a great network of contacts in schools that we could follow up during the pandemic to ask the same students or the same schools about the situation during the pandemic. So this was very important, I think, for us in order to be able to track and monitor violence and abuse rates during this very stressful time for all societies, including the Norwegian one. And it's important for me to say as well, defining violence and abuse is very important when we do this research, because different countries and different cultures consider different types of transgressions against children differently. And in Norway, we have a very strict law on violence against children. So in Norway, it's prohibited by law to pull hair of children, to pull the ear, to just slap them with a flat hand. All kind of physical sort of punishment of children is prohibited. And even physical abuse that can result in very little physical damage to the child is not allowed. And that's also counted in our numbers on violence and abuse in Norway against children. In addition to, of course, sexual abuse and psychological abuse that we defined as repeatedly being humiliated or threatened or ridiculed by a parent. So this was sort of the backdrop of the research that we had at hand when the pandemic hit. And so during the pandemic, we did two more data collections in this study. One during the school lockdowns or right after, to ask about violence and abuse experiences during the lockdown, and a second data collection 1 year into the pandemic, so summer 2021. And this summer 2021 data collection allowed us to compare rates of violence and abuse against children during the pandemic compared to the year before the pandemic. So this was a very important data collection to us, because we could compare the numbers. And of course, during the pandemic, we didn't reach out to that many students as we did before the pandemic because the schools were very stressed with a lot of accommodations to the pandemic. But we reached 3,500 students during the pandemic and then these 9,000 that we had before the pandemic. And what we saw was that a lot of researchers and NGOs and people working with children were, you know, concerned that rates of violence and abuse would increase substantially during the pandemic in all countries, because we knew that all the stressors related to the measures to mitigate the spread of the virus could increase violence and abuse at home, both towards adults, but also towards children. So we were very eager to analyze our data to see how that played out among Norwegian adolescents. And what we saw was, contrary to our concerns and maybe expectations, we didn't see an increase. We either saw stability in rates or a slight decrease, but we saw a slight increase in sexual abuse against children by adults. And this sexual abuse was mostly perpetrated outside of the family, so not inside. So that was kind of surprising to us. I think it was a reasonable concern to have that violence and abuse would increase. And some data show that that has increased, but our data on adolescents and their self-report does not show an increase for the most part, except for the sexual abuse rate.
And is violence against children gendered? Can you tell us in what ways it is gendered and if there are any intersectional aspects to violence against children?
Definitely, yeah. Well, the overall answer to this question is yes, it's gendered. And adolescent girls in our study, both before the pandemic but also during the pandemic, report more violence from both caregivers, but also outside the family, such as sexual abuse. And we also see that girls report more, that the gender difference is larger during the pandemic, actually, than it was before the pandemic. So although we, before the pandemic, also saw this gendered pattern, girls report more exposure to all forms of violence during the pandemic than adolescent boys. So it seems that if during the pandemic, the gender differences have increased and it has sort of become more gendered than we could conclude before the pandemic. We did this survey right after the first lockdown, and we didn't see any gender differences in sexual abuse between boys and girls in person during the lockdown, which is maybe not so surprising because most adolescents were at home during that period of time. But we saw a large gender difference in online sexual abuse, so that girls were more exposed to online sexual abuse during the pandemic lockdown, the first 8 weeks of the pandemic in Norway, compared to boys. So yes, you can see this pattern of gender differences throughout. And in terms of other risk factors, we were very eager to understand what kind of role the risk factors play. And what we saw in our studies during the pandemic was that the same sort of risk factors that are present before the pandemic were also present during the pandemic. But these risk factors were exacerbated during the pandemic. So low SES, socioeconomic status, parents, children or adolescents living with parents who had mental health problems or had previously had mental health problems, parents who had a drug or alcohol misuse problem, and children of parents who had been incarcerated, had been in prison, were all more at risk for being exposed to violence or abuse. And this was the case before the pandemic, but these risk factors were, as I said, exacerbated during the pandemic, and especially during the pandemic lockdown. So, yes, there are a lot of risk factors that played out. What was interesting, too, what we found for the study that we did based on the data from the lockdown, we also saw that adolescents who said that they had been abused before the pandemic, sometimes during their lifetime, were more at risk for being abused during the pandemic. So, as we know, re-victimization is a huge risk factor for being a victim of abuse again, and this was also the case during the pandemic. One main implication that we draw from this was that you know, we need to be aware of these risk factors, and it's important for societies to monitor and know what families are at risk in order to be able to intervene and help families that are at risk for exposing their family members to violence and abuse. Because we know of these risk factors. And first of all, we should, of course, prevent these risk factors in the first place. So lower social disparity and enhance prosper in society. But when we can't, we need to reach out to the families that we know are most at risk for violence and abuse. That was one of the main implications from that study, I guess.
What are the measures and policies that governments take in order to deal with violence? And if you could tell us also about the proposals of international organizations regarding this issue, it would be very helpful.
Sure. Well, in Norway, as in very many other countries, when the pandemic hit, the concern for children, families, women, domestic violence, all these issues were put very high in the agenda. And the concerns were very immediately raised, both by the government and health authorities, but also by NGOs and organizations working to promote children and human rights in Norway. And although schools closed as of March 12, 2020 in Norway, as in most other countries in the world, this concern was quite immediately also taken into consideration by the government and health authorities. In Norway, a number of measures were implemented to reduce stress in families in general and enhance the efforts to follow up families with increased risk for intrafamilial violence and stress. In Norway, we never had a curfew. That was one of the main sort of measures implemented. So although schools closed and workplaces closed and everyone was sent home to stay at home and keep social distance, a curfew was not implemented. So in Norway, you could walk freely outside of your home without having to report to anyone. And you could walk out as much as you wanted, as for as long as you wanted. You could go camping in the woods. you could walk freely outside of your home, which I think reduced a lot of stress for a lot of families that you didn't have this very strong regulation of movement. And you could go to the grocery store and et cetera without having to report anything. But you have to keep a distance to everyone else, right? The 2 meters or 1 meter that we remember. And also, children and adolescents were recommended to have 1 or 2 friends that they met in person, also during these first weeks of the lockdown. So you could have these kind, what was called corona friends. So you could have 1 or 2 friends in an extended cohort. And families and children were very much encouraged to reach out to other children in their neighborhood. So that sort of underscoring the importance for children and adolescents to have the social life and sort of safeguarding children as well. So if anything was going on in the family that wasn't very healthy for them, it would be possible for them to have some outlets through other sources. And of course, the children's TV and in all kinds of media, helplines for children were promoted so that children were aware of how to get in touch with helplines if they were having a hard time at home. So these were important messages, I guess, for children. And also for families at risk for violence and abuse in particular, quite soon after the first lockdown, Child Protective Services were given sort of critical function to society. And that meant that employees in the Child Protective Services, following up families at risk, they were given daycare for their children so that they could work while their children had someone to take care of them. And they had this right alongside medical doctors and nurses and other critical infrastructure in society. So people working in critical infrastructure, they had this alternative daycare for their children, although schools and normal daycare was closed down. And also quite soon, schools had this policy that if children were having a hard time at home, not necessarily only due to violence and abuse, but in general, family stress or special needs, they were entitled to education and having school or daycare. So these were also put in place quite soon in Norway. And also there were put in some more wider measures for society. So parents with children that were 12 years or younger, they were getting more paid sick leave days so they could take the whole or part-time off from work and get paid in order to be able to take care of children without having the stress of sort of also maintaining your work duties. And also people who were temporarily laid off or lost their job from one day to the other, they were financially compensated immediately without having to sort of make any efforts to get another job, or, you know, they were just compensated for that time that they were laid off. So that also put away a lot of stress, financial stress on families, I guess, and on individuals in general. As we know, financial hardship is very much related to violence against both children and women. Also, more specifically for the Child Protective Services, they were asked to consider and prioritize families that they were concerned about. And if they knew about families in their system that they were concerned would violence would escalate, or where, you know, the family was under a lot of stress before the pandemic hit, then they would be prioritized in order to get support and supervision from the Child Protective Services. For the youngest children that we didn't study in our prevalence studies, but for infants and so on, any case with an infant in the Child Protective Services was high on the priority list. So that would be important to follow up. So there were a lot of measures implemented, and also then the Norwegian Institute of Public Health, they were very cautious about advising any closures of schools. So after the first lockdown, there were no entire lockdown of schools. Only maybe if one class or one school had a lot of contagion and so on, they would lock down the schools. But mostly lockdown of schools were discouraged, and schools were under a very strict regimen on how to organize classes so that, you know, contagion would not be an issue. Well, I think, you know, it's hard to say, you know, that one measure is more effective than another, but I guess, you know, that, and we can't say for sure that any of the measures implemented to protect or sort of buffer the stress on children were effective against violence. But I think one lesson learned from the pandemic is that keeping children high in the agenda is very, very important. And still, even if Norway implemented a lot of these measures, they are still being criticized from human rights organizations and children's rights organizations for not doing enough, because we know that children are in a very vulnerable phase of development. Violence or not, these kind of huge stressors like a health crisis, it's very important to be very cautious about how you sort of go ahead and try to protect children from most of the stress associated with such a crisis. And also, of course, what I would say is that we've done research on adolescents, which are phased during development where you are, of course, more at risk for violence and abuse, but maybe mostly out of home because you're starting to go out with friends and seek new relationships. To a larger extent can escape violence from home. You can, you know, ask for help. You can go out and meet other people and so on. Whereas the younger children that are more reliant upon their parents' care and so on, they might be in another situation. And we don't know entirely how that situation has been for younger children in Norway during the pandemic. So that's something we need to investigate more, I guess, because there was probably age differences in how the pandemic played out for children in Norway and in the world in general. So we don't know if the numbers we have from our studies on adolescents are generalizable to children younger in age. That's a question for further study, I guess.
For more information, go to progender.badion.gr.